Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, joined alongside me, Whitney Wright. Whitney, welcome. Well, I guess welcome back, audience.
Yeah, I'm always here.
Yeah, she's always here. and I can be wrangled from time to time.
That's true. Yeah, we've had to replace you when you went to Ireland, but it's good to be here. I am not very great on sleep right now. So, you know, I feel like you had your turn once where you're like, I could say something weird and this is my time.
Yeah, the time change coming back from Ireland was pretty tough because I'd been in the UK 2 weeks prior. And then as soon as I got back, we changed the times here in the US. And
I know
we're 1 week behind.
I know
the Europe and things like that. So yeah, it's being able to try to get everybody on the same page is never easy, especially when it comes to something like time. I was reading that the airlines in particular are
I'm sure it's a mess to try to fly on yep. Daylight Savings Day. People probably miss their flights all the time.
Yeah. Are you familiar in maybe more of the development side of our audience may be familiar with this, but are you familiar with epoch time?
No.
So epoch time is it's kind of a standard in computer programming.
Okay.
And I had to learn about epoch time because I couldn't figure out why this program that I was building, it always kept giving me this error on the timestamp. And anybody that's ever managed a website before can be familiar with that sort of what is the obvious thing here that I'm missing that it seems like shouldn't be a problem? And epoch time is it just gives you a number, and that number is a large one because I believe it's seconds. It's the number of seconds since the start of 1970.
Oh my gosh. And that's just the time.
It's just the time.
Wow. It's kind of nice. Everyone would know exactly what time it is.
Yep. It is the number of seconds since the start of, I believe it's January 1970, but there might be a specific date. I can't remember, but I had to find a converter online. It kept giving me the time as these strange numbers. And I was like, I don't know what that means.
Right.
Since when? Since the beginning of time? How does it know? You know? But yeah, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of things in digital publishing operate that way, where it's nobody fully has adopted everybody else's metrics or systems.
I know. Yeah. We were just talking about Celsius and Fahrenheit, which is not really yeah. digital publishing, but it's just another thing where I can never figure out Celsius when I go somewhere. But we were just saying it's not as precise as Fahrenheit. So it's hard to figure out what it is. But not related to digital publishing. But
I think it's a principle, though, that it is throughout. I mean, it's you see it with just about everything from the number, the things that become popular and become incumbent systems, something like a WordPress. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's not a better CMS or even a more modern CMS today or was back then. It's just there's certain attributes that something has sometimes that makes it, whether it's regional or worldwide, the one that gets adopted. And I think that in digital publishing, it's really good to be sensitive to that.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got some big topics today. We got, Google broad core update. We got an ad industry changing standards and just general shifts in the programmatic market. So we'll jump right in. As many digital publishers will know, on March 15th, Google launched a broad core update. It is the first Google core update of this year, and it's the first one in more than 6 months. It can take up to 2 weeks to roll out. And this is from Search Engine Roundtable and Search Engine Land. They both kind of reported on it, so I pulled from both. Search Engine Roundtable reported that it's more black hat SEO seems to be affected more than white hat. And it looks to be most content. It's not completely focused on anything specific. And its reach is wide and the impact is fast. And Mozcast, they have that, temperature for algorithm or number. I'm not sure if it's temperature, but
they do it kind of like temperature. But I see it get to 117 and stuff like that, which is, outside of being in like Dubai or something like that, I don't think you're going to be hitting 117 right. degrees outside.
Yeah. Yeah. So they showed volatility on the 16th and 17th, which makes sense if they launched this on the 15th. But it was about time that another Google Core update was released. You know, it was kind of impending, I feel like.
I love that it's called the broad core update.
Just no, nothing specific.
Yeah. It's like, If you wanted it to be helpful at all, don't worry. We'll name it something that couldn't ever possibly be helpful.
I know. There isn't a ton of information on it right now. Like I said, it's mostly seems to be affecting Black Hat SEO. So maybe you can kind of go into what that would entail.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple things with this, which the first one, I shared this with a group of publishers a while back, and I'll share it with our audience. Don't tell anyone. The way that Google thinks about this, having spent time there, I had a conversation with a gentleman that was a speaker at one of our events. And about halfway through the conversation, he had realized like, oh, you work with a partner and put these events on. I think that at the start of the conversation, he had assumed that I was on the same team as him. And so there was a fair amount of information that I thought was really interesting at the start of that conversation. And I won't specifically outline some of the things, but I'll kind of give you the cliff notes that I think are helpful. So when Google talks about their core update, the first thing to realize is that every site would be uniquely impacted by any changes that they would make. So when you see these rumor mills and things like that online that are saying, oh, this type of thing or that type of thing, there's no way that it's accurate. Meaning it's somebody else's subjective evaluation of like determining a cause, which may or may not be true. In my experience looking at sites that claim to be affected one way or the other, I would say 50% of the time it has nothing to do with that, or they weren't even affected at all. Mm-hmm. Like it just happens to be like Wednesdays they get less traffic and they were looking at one day. But the biggest thing is that if you think about all the different things that you would ask about, like, well, what changed here? The answers are almost going to be, it depends, all the way down to zero. So even if Google is adjusting something like, a sensitivity to the deviation in how much it's willing to, allow for, similar terms. So like you search for, like, what's the best way to build a sandcastle? What's the best way to build a sandcastle today? Maybe you allowed a lot of deviation on that before, meaning people want completely different answers from those two types of things, to where you turn down the sort of deviation. That means that, like, you know, the same site could appear at the top of both results because people generally want to know the same thing for that query. That would still be just for that type of query. And they may say, well, let's take a weighting score based on how many clicks, you know, go to different sites when an extra word is added or not. And that's going to depend on the query, and that each query might get its own score. So truly it would be unique to literally everything that you ranked for how something like that would change. So it gets really nuanced in that regard. And then the second piece of that is you mentioned the Black Hat thing. So when you think of Black Hat SEO, what do you think of?
I feel like Black Hat is more like I think of like old school, I guess, terms of like putting like
exactly.
white words in the background, like yeah. to get more like, you can put in like keywords and stuff. So you rank for everything. I don't know. That's kind of what I think of.
Yeah. And I think that would be probably what the majority of the audience mm-hmm. would say as well. And the thing is, I mean, when was the last time that you heard of somebody getting a site to rank or, you know, being able to pull off sort of these devious old school Black Hat techniques? It's like these things have gotten stomped out.
Doesn't work anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. It hasn't worked for a long time. And so when you hear somebody say something like, oh, well, it seems to have favored White Hat versus Black Hat, my guess is that that's somebody just sort of like putting out there that they think that sites that were built sort of like the traditional way have performed better. And that people that have tried to maybe take some kind of shortcut or something like that have done worse. And I would say it's probably kind of accurate from the standpoint of like that's the intention of all
right.
Google's updates.
Yeah.
I think people believe that Google is trying to enforce some type of agenda almost on like the types of results, meaning like they think that certain results are better than other results. They're quite agnostic about that, meaning they don't care if it's a video or if it's this or if it's that, there's other things that kind of go into that. But the biggest thing that I would say that Google is trying to do is they started out as the web spam team. Mm-hmm. If you look up the history of sort of like Google's web spam team and how that's transitioned into the webmaster team, you'll learn fundamentally so much about SEO. You could just read like the little brief history of it. I think Wikipedia probably has one. There's other SEO sites that have got some up, but you would learn a lot, quite a bit about SEO just by doing that little like research experiment. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing to think about with all of these updates is that you need to look at your own data, because rankings, and as we traditionally believe, like these things affect, rankings really don't affect your site near as much as the results themselves. There didn't used to be people also asked. There didn't used to be video carousels and product carousels and all the different elements of a knowledge graph and things like that. When those things get populated, even if you're ranked number one, but now there's like five other things that kind of poach the engagement away from people that are searching for that stuff, that can be way more impactful than, you know, another site getting in front of you. So you're not always competing with that. You're competing with sort of like user behavior shifts and trends. And that's really what people should probably pay closer attention to, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So if someone's kind of freaking out about another Google Core update, what would you say to them?
I would say in 15 years, it's probably not going to matter.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that you're going to get the majority of your traffic from Google. But that would be sort of like the long-term view. The medium-term view would be sort of like, you know, take into account the user behavior, like I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then I think the short-term view is step back, look at your data as long as the time frame as you can. Mm-hmm. Because if you got blasted, meaning like you really had traffic fall off a cliff, and I'm not talking like, you know, pretend fall off a cliff. I mean, like you went from getting, you know, 10,000 visits a day to like 40. Mm-hmm. Realistically, you're not doing anything tomorrow that's going to fix that. It's fundamental to your content, or you've messed something up on your site and you just don't know it yet. And you're kind of attributing it to the core update. If you just slowly gleaned down and seen traffic kind of like, you know, kind of draw back maybe a little bit, I'd take a step back just from the standpoint of in most cases, I think it's over like a 60-day time frame. We looked at 10,000 sites, and after every update, looking at 10,000 sites, whether they were negatively or positively affected, I believe that it was like 90 something percent of sites saw no difference. Mm-hmm. And you might see a difference maybe in the first week or 2 weeks or something like that, but it bears out that that's usually seasonality or it's some kind of, you know, like user shift where it's like, you know, these 2 weeks this year, it was raining a lot, so people were indoors, so traffic was slightly up. And then, you know, the following year, it's like maybe it was really sunny outside. So the same amount of internet use takes place over the course of a month, but just these 2 weeks happen to be like one's feast, one's famine, mm-hmm. year over year. So I would say like definitely don't overreact and, you know, take a hard look at your content if you do think something's affected. But I'd steer clear of trying to, you know, read things online and try to respond according to mm-hmm. what you hear other people say.
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's like people, you know, looking at a piece of art and it's like, if it's right in front of your face, you can't see the whole picture.
Yep.
And so like, you need to take a couple steps back. And so you can really see, like, you can see all the details when you're close, but you can't really see what's going on.
Yep, totally.
And so it's like all about taking steps back so you can really see like the whole piece of art. So, don't freak out. Take a step back. And, you know, like you said, it's going to be different in 15 years anyway. So,
yeah, I do think that is true. I looked at, I'm kind of hot on that one because I saw I put it on my Twitter at Tyler Bishop. You don't have to follow me. You can just go check it out. it's a chart, and it shows basically mobile phone market share mm-hmm. by brand. And in 2007, Apple wasn't like even on there.
Right.
It's like in the other category of mm-hmm. like theoretical phones. And then you've got like Nokia and things like that. And then in 2008, Apple's on there, but it's like such a small percentage, you know, and then you fast forward 15 years later, they're the largest company in the world. And that, you know, 11% market share that they had has turned into like the most dominant, like player in the space that you mm-hmm. can't imagine being replaced, who at the time was like this little engine that could up against the likes of Nokia phones.
Which, what are they up to these days?
Yeah, Motorola and Nokia. I think I have a headset at home from Motorola. And then, yeah, I don't know. I have an old Nokia phone that my my nieces play with every now and then.
Yeah, right? Like, that's what happened to old cell phones.
It's like they're missing like, some buttons.
They're just toys now. Well, we have some ad industry changes. The ad industry launches an effort to revise new standard terms and conditions for digital advertising. This is from IAB. It has been more than a decade since the standard terms and conditions for internet advertising has been significantly revised. This was first developed in May 2001, which when I think about it, doesn't feel like that long ago. But then when you consider how many years have gone by, it's like it's been a pretty long time.
Yeah.
In April 2023, so next month, they have a task force that they're assembling with advertising agencies, marketers, publishers, and ad tech companies. And the CEO of IAB, David Cohen, has said simply too much has changed for us not to revisit.
Well, given that they first developed it in during the end of the dot-com boom.
Right. and well, and it's been a decade since they've even looked at it. And like, think about what's happened since 2013.
Yeah. It's pretty, I mean, I guess the bigger question is, you know, why? Meaning, if you look at it, they haven't looked at it in 10 years and it's been 20 years since it was, you know, developed, more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the things that it's taken me 20 years to do, or, you know, a long period of time to do, the reason why it takes that long is usually because it's not very important.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, I do think it's a better question for publishers to think less about what the IAB and what their standard terms and conditions would be, but think more about sort of like your terms and conditions on your site. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of the way that the world is changing, especially as you add in things like GPT and AI, and you think about all the information and data that you are able to collect, or you might have a partner collecting on your website. The last thing you want is to be running a business that's doing well and finally feel like you've got momentum on your side, and then to be hit with legal action or something like that by a user, or by, you know, someone that has a copyright or trademark. I've seen it happen before. Mm-hmm. And it usually happens right at that point whenever a publisher can finally afford probably somebody mm-hmm. to help them with legal expertise. And I don't think that that's a coincidence. And so I would advise publishers to spend some amount of time. I know it's definitely like eating your vegetables. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to hire attorneys. But it is worth taking some time to make sure that you do have terms and conditions on your website that are going to protect you and also like are unique to your site. Every site's going to collect information differently for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you never know how litigious, you know, different parties that you interact with might be.
Yeah. I know that this team that they're assembling, they obviously have people from all different parts of the industry, and they're trying to make it as helpful to both sides as possible. So going forward, I guess we'll see what their new terms and conditions are. The last topic we have is a shift of the programmatic market could benefit publishers. This is from What's New in Publishing. So the market could be moving from an open marketplace, which is what's been popular for, you know, however long, been quite a while. And it seems like it's kind of being directed towards more like curated, controlled environments. And curated deals give buyer and advertisers access to premium curated supply, you know, targeted audiences, contextual environments, focused device types. And ad agencies are beginning to cherry pick a limited number of SSPs to facilitate spend through curated marketplaces. But this shift will shift more control to media agencies. What does that say? This will shift more control to media agencies. Oh, that was lost originally.
Yeah,
to the open market to some extent with the rise of programmatic. Can't read my own notes.
If they were handwritten notes, there were mine, there's no way anyone would read them.
No, this podcast would be over in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it would be over immediately. We'd be deciphering it. We'd need to get cryptologists involved.
And, yeah.
You know, this is the very first thing that I saw, my experience in the space, there's like all these little sort of like fundamental elementary things that I kind of like will scan. My brain sort of scans to figure out like, where is this coming from? Like, which mm-hmm. part of the industry is this coming from? And this is not coming from the publisher side. And if it is, it's from idealistic publishers mm-hmm. that are thinking more probably pie in the sky than they are sort of like in based in reality. And the reason I say that is because if there's one thing we know about display advertising specifically, I mean, it's kind of all to some degree, it's that competition drives prices up for publishers, meaning you want as many active parties bidding as possible because competition is good. It helps publishers. You never want to be in a situation where you're isolated and you can only basically take one avenue of revenue from, you know, whoever, because there's no incentive then in that case for them to raise the price. Mm-hmm. So whenever I hear about these smaller, you know, like more curated controlled environments, yes, you could say like it's better quality now. Mm-hmm. Like I'm going to only sell my inventory to these brands, but this exists today. It's called private marketplace.
Right.
Most programmatic partners that are of any kind of scale or size are doing this. And they went like, we have private marketplace deals running on tens of thousands of sites, and they definitely add and augment revenue because they win bids. They are premium inventory, but here's the thing. If you eliminate all other open programmatic bidding, mm-hmm. the price goes down significantly. You either can't fill the majority of your impressions or the impression value goes down significantly because you don't have this open marketplace right. to compete against. And it's this way with just about everything, right? So like if you think about car manufacturing, somebody like a Tesla or something like that, you know, Tesla is doing everything they can to drive down the cost of their vehicles right now. And it's because now all of a sudden there are other auto manufacturers trying to make EVs. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they know that they're going to have to be more competitive there. Before, it's like, hey, this is like the, not only is it almost the only EV that you can buy, but it's a vehicle that you can only get by buying a Tesla if you want to be mm-hmm. electric. Now you have other options, and so the price has to come down. It kind of works in the inverse if you're on the publishing side, where advertisers have to spend more to be able to get that premium inventory. And agencies, while they can play a role in something like this because they can sort of like spin these things up and create this sort of like consortiums of these, you know, brands and then publishers and kind of mesh them together, they are a middleman in this space. And if you look at, you know, some macro trends, I don't know if this is still kind of happening with the same sort of momentum that it was a few years ago, but the big move was that, you know, ad agencies were getting cut out and advertisers were going more and more in-house. They were wanting to broker these deals themselves. And that really is the best situation if you're a publisher. If you're a publisher, you want to work as closely as possible with advertisers directly. Mm-hmm. And as great as it would be if you could just do a bunch of direct deals, that's going back in time.
Right. Like,
the reason why everything that exists the way that it exists today is because that scale provides a lot of value. Mm-hmm. If you're an advertiser and I'm a publisher, especially a smaller one, like how am I supposed to get the ear of every brand and why would I expect them? And it's hard for them. They may want to be on my site or advertising to my audience. But, you know, when you think about the amount of time that it would take to do a deal with me and the amount of spend that I'm going to take up of their overall budget, it just doesn't make sense for anybody. Mm-hmm. However, if there is a way to have a deal broker between us that is fast, where it's like you can do a deal with not just me, but the 10,000 me's that are out there, it makes a lot more sense. So I'm actually bullish on, I mean, I beat programmatic advertising up a lot, mm-hmm. but it's getting better. I mean, yeah. I hate to say it because it's a very dirty space that has way too many parties in it, and it's growing in complexity. But I am starting to see the role of things like AI and sort of like, I guess, the cynicism from years and years of people being beat up in it, to where I do feel like it's much harder for people that provide no value to sneak in now. And I feel like those that have gotten away with it for a long time, that they're being exposed a little bit more. But I don't think that this is the way forward. I think this is mm-hmm. this is like been talked about for 20 years and it's never really ever shown to be something that's been that viable for advertisers or publishers.
Right. I just think by scale, it doesn't really make sense. But it is kind of this like tug of war between advertisers wanting to be able to control the quality and like what ads, you know, or where their ads are going, and publishers, you know, there's no way, like you said, that they could possibly have that many partners out there. So realistically,
both parties would benefit from a system that'll never happen from. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the first episode, I think that we did when we brought back the show, mm-hmm. I talked about adflation, mm-hmm. the opposite of it's directly correlated to inflation, in that the ideal situation is a one ad network where it's like you have the publishers over here and you have the advertisers over here. The best way to maximize the value of your advertising would be to spend this like huge premium on getting on one site where it's just one ad. Like one ad is just sort of like a euphemism for like maximum engagement. Like I'm going to give you the best ad position that I have as a publisher so that my audience is captive to you and my content, and that's it. Makes my content better. And for the advertiser, the value should be there because you're not necessarily competing. But the problem with that is that the more and more advertising that's been added over time, you know, Google and Amazon and everybody else, they want to be able to provide people, by people I mean advertisers, with more value. So what happens is, you know, advertisers get used to this idea of who can give me the most value for the least amount of money. And then it becomes a race to the bottom. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, advertisers start having benchmarks and KPIs tied to bonuses that are related to them driving down CPC costs. So it's like, you're going to turn around and say, I want to pay the highest CPC costs for fewer ads. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like that's not going to win a lot of boardrooms. And so I don't see the incentive for something like that to take place. For a publisher, it's kind of the same deal. Mm-hmm. It's like that. It's the prisoner dilemma of like, yeah, you could just show one ad on your site and the value will go up because there will be value there. But if all other publishers, you know, have 30 ads on their site and advertisers are all bidding based on what the majority of publishers are doing, there's a gun to your head as a publisher to say, do you want to make money or do you want to try to, you know, trailblaze some new environment that's probably not going to work if it's just you. And that's where I could see something like this working, but it's just to get everybody on both sides of that spectrum to it's what we talked about in the beginning, Celsius, Fahrenheit.
We'll never, you know, America will never take on Celsius, and the rest of the world will not do Fahrenheit. And I see that kind of full circle here. We made it work.
Yeah.
Brought back Fahrenheit. Yeah, it's
like, I feel like that meme from Charlie and Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where mm-hmm. he's got all the lines going and the thumbtacks. Yeah.
Well, that's it for topics. We do have a couple of questions or comments that came through. This is from our podcast in February. It was called The Rise of Generative AI and Meta Ad Targeting Transparency. We had two comments about this, and one was, I'm very concerned about the future of blogging and income. What's going to happen when the great deluge of articles get posted? It just seems like the barriers to entry for writing blogs is gone, and I'm concerned about future monetization. I think this is kind of referencing, generative AI and where that's going and people developing content with AI and competing against robots.
So I would say I wouldn't worry about the barrier to entry for writing blogs to be gone, because that's good. I think that's actually really a good thing, mm-hmm. because if you think about it, the progress that we've made there so far, like think about in 2002, the barrier to entry to be an online publisher. I would say we were still in Web 1 then. So mm-hmm. it's like if you didn't have your own servers, you weren't hosting you couldn't host in the cloud then.
Yeah.
So the chances of you as being like everyday person being able to publish a blog or even an article online basically was impossible, not feasible. And you come to today and it's like, I can grab my phone. The idea, if I would have told somebody in 2002, I can publish blogs on my phone, they'd be like, what's a blog? Why are you on a phone? How does that work?
Right.
You know? And so I think that's only shown that it's good for publishers and good for the ecosystem, because you look at the sort of like nicheification, if you will, mm-hmm. like who my nieces think is famous is somebody that I couldn't pull out of a lineup.
Right.
Like I'd be like, they'd be like, who's this person? I'd be like, I think it might be that guy. And they're like, it's a girl, actually. And I'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's where publishers really have won here in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years. But if you think about the future of AI playing a role into this, artificial intelligence is a tool, and it's a tool that has immense ramifications for every industry and population. We don't know what it's going to look like. But I would say, as it stands today, if you're a publisher that can be disrupted by AI, you already have a business that was going to be disrupted anyway in these next who knows how long, because the barrier to entry to compete with you is already very low. Mm-hmm. That said, most of the content that I see that is like AI has been able to do market beat content for a long time, sports content, summaries of games and things like that. But all source content that the AI that we have today pulls from is human source material. So you think about something like, I always use the How to Stop a Crying Baby example, but I'll use a different one. You know, what's the best candy bar for under $5.99? So AI can do exactly what some content scraper can do. You can go search other people's reviews and piece it together. And these people say that it's like this, or those people say that it's like that. But like, I'm the candy reviewer. Best candy bar under $5 is, you know, Snickers in my mind. And here's why. And this is what I like about it. And, you know, you can kind of like dive into these things, but it's that perspective and that sort of experience that actually is the value of the content. And so AI is going to still need that. Mm-hmm. And it sounds weird because you're like, well, am I going to feed this beast that's going to in turn eat me? And the answer is, it's like, maybe. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mentioned earlier, like in 15 years, you probably won't get most of your traffic from Google. I do believe that that's true. But content, as far as I can tell, robots aren't going to eat candy bars mm-hmm. or sell them for $5. And if they are, God help us all.
Yeah, right.
You know? But because of that, I do think that if you make content for your audience, just don't get complacent. And I think you're going to continue to find that people are out there. They're going to want good content. And AI is going to need people for that content just as much as we're going to need it to do a lot of things for us.
Right. Like you said, I guess feeding the beast, but where is this AI getting the information? It's getting it from humans. So content's still important.
Human information before September 2021.
Yes, currently. Exactly. and so the second question, it's kind of similar. And you kind of answered it, but maybe if there's anything else you can elaborate on, they asked, could you elaborate on how a blogger can stay future-proof in these uncertain times?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of that where, you know, the biggest mistake I see publishers make, and if you've made this mistake, you're like, oh God, he's talking about me. It doesn't matter, because at any given time, you can embrace this sort of philosophy and it will aid you immensely, not just in publishing, but in a lot of different things, in my opinion. And that is that lean into what you know. Mm-hmm. So the piece of advice that I hate is when somebody is working on a new website, or they're trying to figure out what kind of new concept for content do I want to come up with. And they ask other people and they'll say, well, you know, you should pick this one or that one because it's not as competitive, or this one makes the most money, or whatever. It'd be the same as saying, like, what kind of business should you start? And then I'd say, well, hey, you know, like a law firm makes a lot of money, or, you know, like there's not a lot of, you know, restaurants in this area that are, you know, barbecue based or something like that. And you'd be like, well, I don't know anything about barbecue and I don't have a law degree. So making both of those businesses would be really unsuccessful for you. Mm-hmm. However, you might know a lot about like caring for pets. Well, caring for pets, there's maybe a lot of websites on that. Well, there's maybe, you know, a fair amount of, you know, other barbecue businesses in, you know, Carlsbad, California, where we are currently. But the truth of the matter is that doesn't stop you from making the best one. Mm-hmm. You know, like a CVS and a Walgreens are normally right next to each other. Yeah. They used to be in the Midwest. And they said it was always because they actually, all the stores performed better when they were right next to each other. Edward Jones is a financial firm where on almost every block for a while, there was an Edward Jones in the Midwest where I grew up. And the gentleman that was the managing partner there told me once, he said, well, it's because they don't compete with each other. He's like, not every person that lives in even a small town is going to be a customer of ours. So, like the pool is immensely big. Mm-hmm. And even though we're right next to each other, it doesn't mean that they have to compete. It's a completely different customer base. And that's what I would say you can do to future-proof your business is lean into the things that you know, because that's how audiences are. We talked about the nichification of people a little bit earlier. You're going to be able to find that, like, just because somebody else is already making that kind of content doesn't mean you can do it slightly differently or add something from your unique experience. We talked about robots before. Your unique experiences are what is valuable. And who knows, in 10 years, maybe it's the only thing that's valuable.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think something else we've talked about on the podcast is just staying agile, you know, staying on top of what's happening with AI and not being scared of it, just kind of embracing it.
Yeah. And I've seen this in everything from professional athletics to tech. And it's that the people that are fearless and courageous and their sort of like pursuit of learning and having very little ego and being willing to try something new and fail, those are the ones that, you know, it doesn't really matter the decision making as much as it is sort of like the process behind it. So if you're focused on trying to make the right decisions about what the future of your business looks like, the chances are that, like, you're not going to be able to get them all right. So you're better off sort of having a process by which you can kind of test them and go down the line. Because even if you can make all the right choices, eventually you're going to get one wrong. And if one wrong decision is what shutters your business, you know, it's a really, I mean, like, it's just a matter of time. But if you have a process by which you're like, hey, I'm going to try this new thing and it doesn't work out, or you waste a lot of time, hey, you wasted a little bit of time, mm-hmm. but at least, you know, you've eliminated something that, you know, would have ruined your business had you fully committed to it, you know, down the line or something.
Right. Well, that's it for questions and comments.
Good questions.
Yeah, I know. We have a couple more that'll be coming up the next couple of weeks. If you want to submit a comment or question, go to publisherlab.org. We have a little section at the top that you can comment to us. You can get on our YouTube channel. You can watch the podcast on there. You can leave a comment on there. We'll check the comments. You can find us, like I said, at publisherlab.org. You can find all the episodes on there or wherever you find your podcasts. And was there anything else that you felt like you crossed your mind that you wanted to share?
No, I felt like I got to talk about a lot of things that I'm really passionate about right now.
Yeah.
that's why I like those questions and just the topics. They aligned really well with things that I feel like I've been repeating to a lot of customers, mm-hmm. and different publishers that I've been talking to over the last week or so. And I think I would say if you're feeling apprehensive at all out there and just sort of like the state of everything is sort of like a little bit tenuous and like maybe a little bit shaky, it's because it is. Mm-hmm. But that's, you have to look at that sort of like, that's an opportunity, mm-hmm. because the chances are that those that look at this sort of like an opportunity and that have sort of that, you know, mind about them that things are changing, like, you guys are the ones that are going to make it. You're going to be successful. It's people that maybe don't see it coming or think, hey, I'm gonna stay right here.
Keep until, my head down, yeah.
Yeah, until things settle down. I don't think so. Things are going to be settled down for a little while.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we will see you next week. And this has been another episode of the Publisher Lab.